You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by the Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, we're pleased to have with us Daniel Levine, author of Hyde, which is a reworking of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson, which is also actually appended to the back of the book, which is pretty cool. And it reshapes Hyde, in a sense, as perhaps the most understood villain in history. But here and there, maybe. Not completely. thanks so much, Dan, for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, I was looking at the back of your book, and I also went to University of Florida and majored in English literature, and Harry Cruse and Paget Power are my professors.
Oh, wonderful.
Go ahead. Yeah.
No, I obviously didn't know Harry, but I heard a tremendous amount about him.
Yeah, he was definitely a character, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And then two of my nephews that are at CU, where I guess you live in Boulder, do you teach there?
I teach in the area. Okay. I've been teaching at Red Rocks Community College and college in Denver.
Yeah, when I lived there in Denver, I used to climb Red Rocks. They can't do that anymore, I don't think. I always do this. So I was thinking, you know, you talk about in your introduction at the end of the book to the original Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you talk about how the book kind of came to him in a dream. And then you kind of say the same thing happened with you.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell me about that.
I don't know if it was a dream so much that I remember, but what I do remember is I woke up one morning, you know, and I described this in the introduction, but I woke up and I was lying on my stomach and my hand was right on the mattress next to me, and looking at my hand like that just instantly kind of triggered a memory of that scene in Stevenson's original when Jekyll goes to bed in his own bed and they transform overnight without the aid of the potion, and Hyde wakes up and the first thing he sees is his, you know, dark, hairy hand, which is what triggers him to the fact that they've transformed. And somehow I was just kind of smacked by that scene. I just remembered it all at once, and it just was there. Like, the idea for the book was just there. It was like, that's what I should do. I should tell Hyde's side of the story.
That's so funny. And you describe that very well in the opening scenes about, it's almost like Sartrean, in, you know, like in The Nausea, where, you know, he looks at something and it's like the very essence of it, and it's almost like kind of disgusting, but just the idea that this thing does exist. And it's, for me, you know, it's like, for you, I'm thinking it should have been fodder for some psychoanalysis for you.
rather not pay a professional, just to do it myself.
That's what's great about being an author.
I think so.
And you get to lie all the time, which is really good too.
I know.
Well, think about it. I mean, do you feel like you had this almost like compulsion to write about Hyde, but then, you know, Dr. Jekyll's, and at least in your reweaving of it, Dr. Jekyll has this patient who evidences, in a Freudian sense, these multiple personalities. And in the Jekyll and Hyde aspect that you talk about, it's because of a father who is not the greatest father in the world. So do you actually think in your view of the world that these kinds of things actually do evidence themselves? I'm not putting that well.
I totally understand what you're saying. I mean, I think what's interesting about the Jekyll and Hyde story is it's, you know, it's specific and it's general. It's general in the sense that, you know, I think everyone experiences this kind of inner schism, you know, and I think partly this is just a product of kind of consciousness, you know, the ability to recognize yourself, and then the necessity to have to engage in society, which has a lot of expectations and a lot of rules and and you really, you know, you have to conform yourself, and to a certain, a large extent, you have to constrict yourself. You have to constrict a lot of the inner impulses or things that you'd like to say that, you know, you really shouldn't say, or things that you'd like to do that people would consider, you know, horrifying or embarrassing at the very least. And so I think everyone experiences this kind of basic split, you know, and I think in a sense, in a general sense, that's what Hyatt is. He's this kind of, you know, the primal impulses, you know, the part of ourselves that we have to repress in order to engage with polite society. But then I had to make it specific, you know, in the story. And, you know, the way I went about making it specific was trying to diagnose, you know, Dr. Jekyll specifically, because not all of us obviously have such a pronounced dark side, or, you know, a specific alternate personality. You know, most people are not, thank God, you know, suffering from multiple personality disorder. So I had to create one in him. And, you know, a lot of times this disorder comes from childhood trauma, parental abuse. That seemed, you know, fairly evident. There's sort of subtle allusions to Jekyll's father in the original that were sort of intriguing. Hyde destroys the portrait of Jekyll's father in mm-hmm. the end of Stevenson's. He burns his letters, which was sort of telling. And then, you know, the case that Jekyll was treating in France was sort of designed to act as a mirror, you know, an opportunity for the character to talk about the condition without actually talking about himself. So as he talks about Emile Verlaine, we learn about his own condition, but it's indirect.
Yes, you know, some of the reviews have talked about it as simply a stripping away of the superego, but I never looked at it that way. I never looked at it like there's somebody with an angel on one side of his shoulder and a devil on the other, like in a cartoon. I kind of looked at it like more of a yin and yang thing, because there's an admixture of each in the other, and I think that might have been what you were really trying to do.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think that, you know, I think Stevenson had to simplify it, partially, you know, for the Victorian audience that wanted such things simplified. I don't know that Stevenson believed that we're composed of good and evil, you know, so dichotomously, and I don't either. But I, you know, I like what you say about the yin and the yang. You know, there is, you know, for all that humans can do, and we're capable of incredible things, you know, incredible creativity and ingenuity and goodness, you know, there's a terrible destructive power to human nature, you know, a terrible darkness, you know, that I think is very innate in the kind of animal that we are.
I think it's, you know, there's a very thin veneer of civilization. It's kind of like the crust on a creme brulee, you know, and like once you crack it, it's really hard to get it back again. And I think that's what happens to a lot of people, whether it's in war or a post-traumatic stress situation, that all of a sudden what was holding you on the earth's crust is no longer there. And I think that's – but the thing that's different about you is that you have this struggle. You know, Hyde has this struggle with this. And it's the struggle, I think, that's most important in life.
Yeah, I think so too. That's a great image, actually. I really like that, the creme brulee.
Yeah, but if you know, creme brulee and tiramisu, no matter what restaurant you go to, they're always different. They're never the same. But if the crust is no good, you know, you just might
exactly,
as well not bother.
Exactly.
Well, it's funny. Go back to, like, in the introduction to the old book, you talk about, so like he dreamed it and then he wrote it, and then tell our audience what happened after he wrote it, because it's kind of like.
He presented it to his wife, as he always did. His wife was hyper involved in everything that he did. Stevenson allowed her to be. He was quite uxorious, as he describes himself in that sense. So, you know, she was his first reader, and he showed it to her, and you know, her reaction was that she was kind of missing the opportunity for a real morality tale. And probably what she was pushing for maybe was the clearer definition between Jekyll and Hyde and the good and evil. And so Stevenson very petulantly threw the first draft in the fire and just instantly kind of set about rewriting it. His son or his son-in-law has this memory of kind of coming into the room and just, you know, Stevenson points at the fire where the ashes are, the manuscripts are burning. And then he just kind of rewrote it in a matter of days. You know, I mean, the whole thing was, you know, a week or two in composition. Was kind of incredible. And then the second draft presumably met with better approval.
It's really hard to imagine writing something and then just tossing it in the fire like that.
But I know. I mean, it would be the equivalent of just like deleting it from your hard drive, which in itself is seems really painful. But back in the days of, you know, actual paper and coal fires, it must have been a little bit tempting, I suppose.
I know. Now there's so much redundancy and you can't possibly lose anything. It's either in the cloud or you've got it backed up in three places. But then you had a manuscript that you, like Joyce, when he wrote Ulysses, you have a manuscript and then you have to have someone decipher it to do a fair copy. And
exactly.
It could easily just go blow away somehow. Like with
all kinds of stories like that. You know, like Hemingway, his wife bringing him a suitcase with all his stories, and then the suitcase got stolen at a train station. Just like basically everything he'd ever written was just gone.
Or like, and the opposite, like with Kafka, you know, he tells Max Brod, you know, burn everything.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
We wouldn't have America or the castle or any of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, thank God.
Well, so the interesting thing, when I read the book, I hadn't read any of the reviews. Then I read them afterwards, which I like to do it that way. But, you know, the idea of no dialogue markers, which is what they say, and I say you have quotes in italics, I think that was really, at first it was like disquieting to me because I wasn't sure whether I was reading thoughts or voices. And I think that's kind of the effect you wanted. I mean, you know, these aren't two people, but they are two people. And and I think that's a very effective way of conveying it. What was your thought process? Because you must have at some point said, you know what I think I'm going to do, right?
Yeah. You know, I guess I knew I didn't want to have dialogue markers, I mean, as in quotation marks. You know, and I mean, obviously, a lot of other writers do this. You know, Cormac McCarthy does it. You know, specifically, I've been reading John Banville's The Book of Evidence over and over, and he does that there. And it just has this, as you say, it has a disquieting kind of effect. And it also has, I find, an internalizing quality in that it makes the narrative seem kind of less formal, in the sense that quotation marks are, you know, it's a punctuation mark, you know, but we don't think in quotation marks. And so the absence of them makes it more informal and I think kind of more internal, as though it's emerging from someone's head.
Well, plus,
but, you know, the problem was that it was and then I didn't want to, I also kind of wanted it to blend into the paragraphs, which was also going to create an internalized sense rather than having every line of dialogue in a separate line. And so everything was blending together, and I needed a way to distinguish at least one set of dialogue, you know, in a conversation. And so I decided to put both Jekyll and Hyde's dialogue in italics. So whenever they're talking, it's in italics, which helps to distinguish it from whoever they're talking to. But then also, I think it kind of emphasizes a certain quality of their voice. You know, I think the way that they speak is distinct and sort of definitive, you know, in the sense that, you know, I hear Jekyll's voice is kind of rich and powerful, and, you know, he's a psychiatrist, he's a you know, he practices hypnotism, so, you know, there's a power to his voice, whereas Hyde's voice is more unpracticed, it's more raw, he's uncertain of himself, and so I think the italics can kind of go both ways in establishing that quality.
Especially at the beginning when he thinks of himself as, like, being stunted, you know? Like he's growing up inside of this thing, and he doesn't see himself as this huge, well-built, well-muscled man. He doesn't see himself as that at all.
Yeah.
But one thing from the other side, from my side of the microphone, is that whether knowingly or not, you make the reader work a lot harder, which I think is great, because the reader has to decide, one, who's talking? Is this a real voice? And what is it telling us about the change in the character? Because it does. It changes. And and you're not looking at exclamation points and quotation marks and dashes and things like that. And you're just, you know, you're moving along with the flow of it, but at the same time, it requires you to work. And that also requires you to go back and read it over again, which is also, I think, a very good thing, too.
Good. I mean, I imagined it could be more work, which is not necessarily something you want to subject your reader to, but if they don't mind it, that's okay.
I realize the bad part of me interviewing is I don't really ask questions. I make statements, and then the author doesn't know what to say. Well, you know, it's like the other thing that's really cool about that whole aspect of the way you write is that Hyde knows that Jekyll has these corners that he's buttressed off, windowed off, walled off, that he can't look into. And it's an interesting thing that, you know, again, Joycean, like there's this interior monologue going on that we're inside of a mind where we know that some of it's walled off, some isn't. It wasn't that hard for you to tie. Didn't that get confusing for you sometimes when you were writing it? Did you lose sight of where you were?
Yeah, I really had to. I mean, it was a process. You know, I had to kind of establish for myself what Hyde knows of Jekyll, you know, and I think in my earlier drafts, I had the sense that there was a transparency between them in the sense that Hyde could kind of narrate all of Jekyll's life. But that didn't quite seem right to me, you know, especially since Hyde is sort of, he is a subsidiary personality, and, you know, and Jekyll has this kind of masterful mind, and he's a student of the mind. And, you know, so it sort of would make, and, you know, and he's a master of secrets as well. He's, you know, he's been keeping secrets his whole life. And so it seemed likely that he would have almost a sort of organizational system in his mind, you know, the way that people do when they're repressing things very deeply. You know, I mean, it's an actual psychological function, the way people just lock away memories from themselves. It's kind of incredible, you know, and so it didn't seem like much of a leap to think that he would and could be keeping things from Hyde that he doesn't want Hyde to know.
Yeah,
it destabilized his experiment.
And it's good. The other good thing is the way you turn it into an anatomical kind of thing. Like, you know, the way Hyde's behind his eye, you know, you can just see his finger reaching up and pulsating, or when his sternum is quivering, or when he first hears the word Georgiana, or he doesn't hear the word, he knows it is some powerful word.
And yeah,
those kinds of things are really cool for a reader.
Good. This is good.
And then, but the other side of the coin is like there's a lot of books out there now. And did you think about this? Like, I mean, starting with Wicked, or with all the silly zombie books, you know, like Abraham Lincoln being zombie killer and Joan Austen and the zombies and stuff like that. Did you have any trepidation about reworking a classic? And taking a character that exists and having the courage to put the actual book at the end of it, but taking this character and making it your own again after he's already existed for 100 and some odd years.
Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, it's amazing. It's a very popular genre all of a sudden.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and there's, you know, Havisham and,
oh, yeah,
and Ahab's wife and, you know, and a number of Pride and Prejudice books. You know, so it's, you know, then there's The Historian. So, I mean, in a way, I didn't worry that it was such a, you know, a revolutionary thing that I was doing. You know, it certainly wasn't. It's a genre at this point. But, you know, the question of, you know, I mean, I think my biggest concern was doing it right, doing it well, serving well the original material, you know, not just because it is a gimmick, you know, and I knew that it was a gimmick, but it's not to say it can't be kind of well accomplished, you know, and so I wanted to do justice to Stevenson and to the original material and not just use it as a gimmick. And I mean, I would say my biggest fear while I was writing it was not whether it was a good idea or not, but whether someone else was going to do it. You know, because it struck me, I was like, this is such an obvious idea. In many ways, it's a very good idea, you know, and it's a marketable idea. It seems likely, given that other people are doing these kind of books, that someone else somewhere is working on it as well. So I definitely had, you know, sort of nightmarish scenarios about, you know, someone completing it before I did, or some big name writer who was also going to announce that he was working on it or she was working on it. So,
or someone getting an option to a studio before
exactly.
you do. Because it will make a great movie. Although somehow in my mind I see Robert Downey Jr. lurking around there, but I don't know exactly what he would be doing.
Robert Downey Jr. as Jekyll and Hyde?
I don't know. It's just like, you know, I don't know why him. Because, you know, maybe because of the Sherlock Holmes stuff. But it just seems like he's of the period, that's all. But he wouldn't fit anyone. Why, do you have anybody in mind?
I'd like to see Daniel Day-Lewis take a crack at it.
Yeah, that would be good.
Or, you know, Ralph Fiennes, I think he would do a wonderful job. Daniel Craig, I don't know.
Well, definitely.
I would love to see it made into a movie. It would be wonderful.
Well, it'd be interesting because the director or the screenwriter would have to decide, okay, are we actually going to use makeup to change this person into this person, or are we going to actually have two people and let the viewer suspend his disbelief for that portion?
I mean, it's a good question because, you know, when they first started performing it, you know, back in the 1880s, shortly after it was published, they had an actor on stage, and he would just become Hyde, you know. And I, from what I understand, they didn't use makeup, you know, in particular. He just would change his affect, his posture, his mode of speaking, and apparently it was terrifying. You know, audiences were quite frightened. And then all the movies subsequently used this, you know, very dramatic makeup. You know, they make Hyde look like a beast. You know, and I would love to see it kind of done more psychologically. You know, just see the actor transform himself into another character rather than relying upon some sort of, you know, stagecraft or makeup.
Which brings up something that happened to me last night that was really funny. I was talking to my daughter Annie, who's 12, because she saw me reading it. We were talking about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and how it started and Robert Louis Stevenson and you and what you had done. And I was trying to explain to her, I was being a big shot. I was trying to be very erudite so she would get smarter. And, you know, talking about the nature of good and evil and my dumb cream brulee thing. And and how there's an admixture, I think I said admixture, of things that, you know, allow us to be a certain way, but if we don't watch out, we're going to switch into the other thing. And she goes, oh, like the Nutty Professor. And it's just like, you know, and then I was thinking, you know, a computer would have a hard time analogizing all of what I said to her into, oh, like the Nutty Professor. But human beings have the ability to, you know, shape these different things together, and all of a sudden, oh, it's like this.
And I mean, that's incredibly astute on her part. Like, Nutty Professor totally is a Jekyll and Hyde remake.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I said to her. I was really astute, Annie.
Yeah.
And then, like, you were, and what made me think of it was because Jerry Lewis in that movie actually just, you know, how they bend over with their arms over their head and kind of writhe around, and then all of a sudden, he's Buddy Love, you know? Well, so, speaking of the nature of evil, how do you feel about it? Do you feel like the reviews say, nobody is really good or evil in this book? And I guess that's kind of the way I felt. So one, is that correct? And two, do you believe in evil as like something being totally evil, a black and white kind of world?
I don't think I do believe in evil.
Really?
I think it's certainly like a human concept, you know, in the sense that in the natural world, you know, outside of humans, there isn't evil. There's terrible cruelty and, you know, violence and horror, but, you know, it's not evil in the sense that it's directly malicious. You know, humans, of course, are directly malicious, and they do terrible things to each other deliberately, you know, and there are many people who certainly seem to be evil. You know, I mean, torturers and, you know, rapists and murderers and, you know, dictators, all sorts of horrible people. But I don't know. I find it hard to talk about evil in terms of some sort of pure concept that exists, you know, that like possesses people. You know, I think people do terrible things because, you know, partly their brain chemistry is sort of deranged or, you know, abnormal, and then they've probably had horrible experiences. You know, and there are, obviously there are cases of people with a perfectly normal childhood. They'll do terrible things, but I'm very hesitant to sort of ascribe it to a pure evil that kind of exists outside of circumstance.
It's interesting. It's like, you know, a lot of people believe that, you know, they always say time was invented by people so that everything doesn't happen at once, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And time is kind of an absolute, but it's very ephemeral in a lot of ways, and it's certainly, like, this interview is probably sounds like it's forever for you, but and you have to do like 10 a day. But I guess the thing about you waking up that morning and looking at your hand, it seems like it. Why? I mean, what was it in your life that says, okay, hey, that reminds me a lot of Hyde and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? I mean, there's got to be something there. It's just very curious to me. Why?
Yeah. You mean, why would the idea occur to me?
Yeah, I mean, okay, you wake up, there's your hand. You see it every morning. Mm-hmm. Had you just finished rereading Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
No, I hadn't. I hadn't read it in years and years. Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I don't know. You know, I mean, sometimes I've had fanciful moments, you know, in considering it, where I've almost thought that, I don't know, you know, Stevenson was influencing me in some sense, you know, in the odd coincidence of the dreamlike nature of it, you know, that it sort of came to him in his sleep and it came to me in his sleep. You know, I think it also is our sleep and dreams have a purpose, in a sense, you know, like they have a primal purpose. They sort of, they prepare us for certain situations, or they sort of allow us to work through various neuroses or various fears. And Stevenson's original dream was the sort of dream of this man going into a cabinet and drinking a potion and turning into someone else, you know. And I think this kind of basic fear of and fascination with metamorphosis, you know, humans turning into something else, has been around for thousands and thousands of years. I mean, that's a part of primitive mythology.
Yeah,
you know?
I think...
And so I don't know. I wonder if there's something very universally kind of human about this that we all kind of tap into, you know, the fact that we do have similar dreams with each other.
I think,
you know,
there definitely
kind of very uncanny coincidences. And, you know, I don't know. So it's very possible that something traveling universally kind of through human consciousness, and it touched Stevenson and it touched me. I don't know. That's certainly a fanciful explanation, but...
Well, I think is that if you weren't an author and you hadn't written this down, I think that moment would have stayed with you for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
I think that mm-hmm. that moment would have been one of those seminal moments, a moment of epiphany, that would have stayed with you. Because there's, you know, you have a few of those right in your lifetime where you know you'll never forget it. And I don't mean like the kind where were you when Kennedy was shot? I don't mean like that, or 911.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just something in you.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing you're right about too is, like, you know, even if you go back to like The Last Temptation of Christ by Nikos Kazantzakis, or the movie, you know, some Christians really didn't like this, but Jesus had this internal struggle, you know, like, hey, God, I don't really want you. Jeez, why are you making me do this, you know? I really don't want to do this. I just want to get married, have a nice life. So it's this constant struggle that all of us have, you know? It's like, am I supposed to strive for being divine? Am I supposed to give way to my base instincts, or am I supposed to try and find a compromise between the two? I think that's what we do every day when we wake up.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, there was another one that wasn't a question. Sorry.
No, it's an interesting thought.
Well, so let me read like this one paragraph because I wanted to ask you a question afterwards. Okay. This is how you write, so readers, listeners will know. Okay. And I read this to Annie last night. Okay. The sky was low with pewter light over the irregular line of houses. A rime of dirty snow crusted the ground in the central park. A dog was yapping. Hotels spelled their names in large vertical letters. Houses looked shut up for the season. The air had a damp chill, and I clenched my teeth to keep them from chattering as I approached Big House, standing grandly distinct from its shabbier neighbors. The brick facade soared from the front steps. Black shutters and ivory trim adorned the many windows, and symmetrical chimney stacks stood erect against the shifting sky. The huge black door had a brass knocker and a bell button. I grasped the brass ring, shockingly cold, and rapped on the plaque. So that's a very good paragraph. And when you read it, you know, you think, okay, this sounds a little bit like Charles Dickens. It sounds a little bit like Stevenson. But somehow it also sounds modern, like the part where the hotels spelled their names in large vertical letters. So a lot of the book is like that. And what it does that a lot of modern books don't do because they're so spare is you have a perfectly, and I mean, this is something that you obviously, and you have a master's in fine arts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is the kind of thing when you write over and over again so that someone who's reading it can see the picture, or a screenwriter or the screenplay can read this paragraph and create the exact scene. Is that something you strive for? Because it's very well done.
Yeah. The cinematic quality in particular is something I strive for. I think ideally, and the kind of writing I like, and you know, the writing I'd like to do is you know, not only visual but just intensely sensual in the sense that it's there, which is obviously what's so wonderful about film. You know, it's immediate. It's there. You see all of these details, and what's very tricky about writing is that you have to choose those details, and you have to present them in a certain order, and you have to make them seem as though they all contribute to an ongoing scene.
It's hard to do. I mean, it's really hard to do.
Sorry.
It's really hard to do. It's almost like you created some kind of storyboard in your head.
It is. I mean, it is hard to do, you know, and I think the way I try to think about it is, you know, if this were a movie, you know, I thought about this very cinematically in the sense that, you know, I think it would make a good movie. I'd like to watch it, and it should be told in that manner. And so, just in terms of if you were filming this and you were moving through Leicester Square, which is being described here, you know, what would the camera pick up? You know, like what would you focus on? You know, what would you be hearing? You know, and generally whenever I was approaching a scene or got stuck, I would say, if this were a movie, how would this be done? What would the character do? What would we notice here? What would be an interesting camera angle or detail that the camera would focus on?
Well, it's funny because like in the very end, you know, it has, you had to be sitting there at the table or in bed thinking, because it has a brass knocker and a bell button. Mm-hmm. And you know, what he grasps is a brass ring, which the reader knows is the knocker, and it's very cold, which the reader feels, and he raps on the plaque, which is fine, but what the reader does is he hears the rapping, which you don't write about. So I can hear it rapping in my head, because I've heard enough of them rapping, so I can hear it in my head. And I think that's what is really cool about that kind of writing, is that the reader is allowed to participate on his own afterwards. And so you have that resonation, you know, literally and figuratively. Do you think that, like, when you write, you know, when you wrote this, and when you, especially when you let it out, and it's, you know, just been published, do you, like, feel like you're letting your firstborn out and, oh, how's he going to do? Oh, is he going to be okay? Should I worry about him? Did you do that, or do you, like, oh, it's okay, it's yours now. You guys do what you want with it.
I'm trying to be the latter. You know, I mean, obviously there's some trepidation, and there's a certain feeling of protectiveness about it. But, I mean, what's nice is that at this stage, you know, a lot of people have read it. A lot of people have had their hands on it. You know, I found the most vulnerable part was, you know, when not that many people have seen it, when it's just been you. You know, I've just been working on this for several years, and maybe I've shown, you know, certain bits of certain drafts to people, but finally it's finished, and you show it to people, and then everyone, you know, it's like this, it's like a, you know, I thought of like a hard-boiled egg, you know, with the shell off. And it's just white and perfect, and then everyone gets their grubby hands all over it, you know, and it's just instantly kind of smudged, and it has everyone's opinions on it, all over it.
Hey, that sounds just like one of your paragraphs.
That I find really difficult. At this stage, I feel like it's just kind of been so polished that I don't feel quite as protective of it. You know, I feel like, I mean, I hope it does well. I hope people like it. If people wrote negative reviews, I'm sure I would feel the cut.
No, they've been uniformly positive.
I do feel a little distanced from it, which is nice.
Well, so have you, are you already starting on something else, or had you been starting on something else before this process?
Yeah, I've had a few ideas kind of banging around in my head. I have one that I've been researching and starting to develop. It's still really nascent, but kind of deals with, like, human origins, human evolution. Might be writing about Neanderthals a bit, because I'm really interested in Neanderthals, but I shouldn't make any guarantees publisher might frown.
Well, it's interesting about Neanderthals now, because, you know, there's this fight going on back and forth, you know, like whether caffeine's good for you or not, about whether Neanderthals and Cro-Magnon man, you know, were the same line. Did they merge? Were they completely separate and one made the other one extinct? You know what I mean? Right?
Yes.
Maybe your book will touch upon that. I find that fascinating.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting about Neanderthals is, I mean, they were, you know, a distinct species from us that was living in different areas of the world that had evolved from a similar ancestor, but, you know, circumstances had sort of taken them divergently, physically and cognitively. And there certainly seems to be some interbreeding between them, which is interesting. But, you know, I think what's more interesting to me is thinking about these other species of human beings that were enormously successful, you know, and been around for far, far longer than we've been around.
Right.
And, you know, living very well and, you know, wondering what that lifestyle was like, you know, what it was like to live in the earth before we came around and really changed it, you know, and developed it, and what their perception of the world was and how they thought, you know, I find that very interesting. You know, I don't think it's a perspective that's really been explored too much in books. So,
no, I know what you're going to do. You're going to become an alternative historian. You're going to have, it's going to be what if
yeah.
Neanderthals took over? What would the world be like now? That's what you're doing.
Yeah.
I bet.
It'll be interesting.
But I remember reading that, I think it was Gene All or whatever name, the Clan of the Cave Bear, and what were the other ones? There were like a bunch of them.
Oh, yeah. The whole series.
Yeah, I remember I was way younger. I really enjoyed reading those. It was like the Mary Renault books, you know, the Greek books. But, okay. I'm going off on an incredible tangent now. all right, well, I think I've done most of the talking, and I've gone through everything I can think of. Anyway, thank you very, very much for joining us today. It was a wonderful conversation when I could let you get a word in edgewise. And
thank you, Seth.
It's a great book. Well, as you know or may know, you know, we have an independent bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop. I have a pretty certain feeling that this will be one of our book club picks, and as soon as I'm allowed to, it'll be sitting there on the, you know, the front table. Well, I guess I am allowed to now. It is on the front table. And I'm sure it'll be very, very popular. And then maybe you can come back when the Neanderthals control the world.
Exactly. It'd be delightful.
Okay. Thanks again very much.
Thank you so much, Ed. It was a real pleasure.
That was Daniel Levine, author of Hyde, just published. Alternative, backed him into a corner there about his Neanderthal book, but it's kind of not an alternative history. It's an exposition on what the real Hyde was like. It's a psychological evaluation of what Robert Louis Stevenson might have done had he decided to delve deeper into the psyche of what's historically become one of the greatest villains in literature. And what we talked about, you know, like yin and yang, like, you know, nobody is perfectly evil, no one is perfectly good, and how one resides within the other. So it's a fascinating book. And like I said, he's brave enough, courageous enough to put the entire Jekyll and Hyde book after his book and give an introduction to it. But I think it's an excellent gloss on the original book. And I also think it's the kind of book that makes you think. And like I told him, the writing is excellent. And it's the kind of book you go back and read the paragraph over and over again. Anyway, so next week on The Avid Reader, we'll be talking with Charles Belfour about The Paris Architect, his new book, which is about a story, it is a story of occupied France, specifically Paris. It's about collaboration between the French and the Germans, about, again, atrocities, about honesty, remembering that you're human, kind of what we talked about today and how hard that is sometimes. So, in any event, that will be next week. Thanks so much for joining us on The Avid Reader, and we'll talk to you then.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.